are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, February 27th, 2020. I'm Michael Brooks. This is a Michael Thursday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Alex Salmon. He's a writer for the American Prospect. We're talking about his new piece, Barack Obama's Legacy is Narendra Modi. As Trump visits India and pogroms continue against Muslims, and the Modi government continues its war on India's Islamic population, we talk about the relationship between Obama and Modi. Is it a micro case study for neoliberalism facilitating global authoritarianism? In Brazil, outrage as Jair Bolsonaro appears to endorse protests calling for a military coup. President Lula saying Brazilians must act against this authoritarian move. Surprise of all surprise. Remember that coup that some folks had a really hard time calling a coup in Bolivia? Happened several months ago. Some people thought it was a green uprising. Well,
Yashkamak.
Yashkamak.
Hasn't tweeted about Bolivia since November.
He has not tweeted about Bolivia since November. A lot of people have been keeping their mouths shut. Well, it looks like a new statistical analysis reported in the Washington Post completely undermines the U.S.-backed OAS's accusations of voter irregularities. And apparently, shock of all shocks, Evo Morales won the election before that coup.
By the way, observing the statistical patterns, the left was in the moment.
The left was in the moment, that you could have heard if you were reading Mark Reisbach or Guillermo Long or anybody that wasn't totally cynical and had a slight idea of what they were talking about. ODC confirms the first possible community transmission of the coronavirus in California. Mike Pence, the man put in charge of handling this virus by the Trump administration, had a homophobic policy in Indiana that sparked an HIV outbreak. What a surprise there. Did Donald Trump just fire his pandemic response team? And apparently there are a lot of authoritarian moron superdelegates in the Democratic Party, because they're telling the New York Times they are prepared to throw out the results of a democratic process to stop Bernie Sanders with electoral powerhouses like Chris Coons, even as other candidates in the race continue to make noises about not endorsing the Democratic outcome of the Democratic primary. Elizabeth Warren reverses herself, now using anti-single-payer talking points from the right. A new poll show Bernie Sanders with leads in Virginia and Colorado. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Folks,
you said a vision of footage of the Trump administration responding to coronavirus, but done in a style of The Apprentice. And it made me feel very scared for the world.
Omarosa comes back. She's like, all right, Mr. The president is coming. We've got a plan. Everybody be cool, calm, and collected. President Trump is coming.
You said you're going to have a vaccine, but this is a hard-boiled egg.
Yeah.
Stephen Baldwin apologizing.
Just like, your task was create a vaccine and build concentration camps for all people of color. And instead, you've given me a Jamba Juice that doesn't even taste like juice. Sorry, Mr. Trump. I think what happened was Meatloaf didn't do his assignment. We all know that Meatloaf is totally incompetent. I've said it many times. But Stephen, a CEO, that was the best part of the Apprentice, was that he said, he always would say that the group lead takes responsibility That is actually maybe the funniest thing that Donald Trump has ever said. Sorry to say it. We all know that meatloaf is terrible, but when you're in charge, you take responsibility.
Buck stops there.
The buck stops at the top. What sound are we starting with? Number one? Okay. So the coronavirus is obviously starting to sort of pick up notice. This is something, every time we have a kind of global outbreak like this, we need to think back to the global gutting of public health, which started with the Reagan administration in the 80s, but it's accelerated. World Bank and IMF austerity programs to this day force developing countries to cut and not invest in medicine. International pharmaceutical cartels don't invest in responsiveness to diseases that emerge in the global economic periphery. And in the United States, of course, decades of austerity have left people vulnerable. This really is another very obvious and great argument for having single-payer Medicare for all as a basic act of protecting global and national public health. Here is a hearing from yesterday with Congresswoman Jane Schakowsky from Illinois. This is on the House Budget Committee. And she is going to be grilling Alex Azar, who is of the HHS, and there had been,
Health and Human Services.
Health and Human Services. And with regards to some comments that had been made, and she'll explain in the clip, about whether or not a corona vaccine would be affordable.
Reaffirm, then you're saying it will for sure be affordable for anyone who needs it.
I'm saying we would want to ensure that we work to make it affordable, but we can't control that price because we need the private sector to invest. The priority is to get vaccines and therapeutics. Price controls won't get us there.
Mr. Secretary.
So that is extraordinary. Take that in. This is the head of the government, Health and Human Services. We talked yesterday about why having state funding and state industry that provide the most basic services. And in this case, where that certainly was not like, this is John Kenneth Galbraith, who was a great progressive intellectual. He was not a socialist, okay? This is very basic stuff that anywhere out of extreme, extreme danger to everybody on the planet, capitalism, we would all agree on. And you have this is not the CEO of a pharmaceutical company trying to undermine important public policy through donations and propaganda, but an agent of that propaganda as head of Health and Human Services under Donald Trump. This is a tweet from David Griscom, producer on The Michael Brooks Show, that is actually really important. So he's quote tweeting Michael McAuliffe, who quoted that exchange. Azar, who's Health and Human Services, refuses to promise a coronavirus vaccine will be affordable for anyone. We would want to ensure that we work to make it affordable, but we can't control that price because we need the private sector to invest. Price controls won't get us there. And David Griscom wrote, one day we will regard the cruel cost-benefit analysis of capitalism that results in so many deaths as part of the massive death tolls of this barbaric human-created system. And that's exactly right.
When we
create the black book of capitalism, The millions and millions of preventable deaths from AIDS, from pneumonia, from malaria, not to mention just basic deprivation of health care that leads to tens of thousands of people to die every year in the United States, is going to be on the books. And of course, we all know empirically that the production of low-cost and generic drugs and state-funded drugs and price controls have been the only way that we've ever controlled disease outbreaks.
I mean, like, we all expect a lot worse, I mean, frankly, than the coronavirus in the next 50 years, you know, worldwide. Sure. Pressures on supply chains.
Yep.
And the very first test Rory's talking about, some people aren't just going to be able to afford this vaccine. We're going to work to ensure that we try to get there. But some people are going to be left out.
And as soon as you have a conversation it's very, you know, it's very easy to say like, hey, well, look, you know, some healthcare is like a luxury, man. This is why you can't have that conversation. This is why actually we do need some Aaron Bastani discourse. The most luxurious healthcare imaginable should be publicly provided for, deliverable 24/7 and free for every single human being. It's both morally obvious and a absolute strategic necessity in an age of, well, I mean, these diseases are only going to climate change and ag policy. They're coming. I mean, something that's been way less melodramatic, but the proliferation of Lyme disease across the Northeast, that was not a thing in the same way a couple decades ago. It existed. But the warmth of the climate has proliferated this thing that actually is very dangerous if you don't treat it. All right, folks. Brendan.
I was just going to remind everyone that Alex Azar was previously the president of Eli Lilly, a pharmaceutical manufacturer. And
that's
shocking. Contributed over $100,000 to their political action committees over the years.
So he actually wasn't part of like a public health group. He wasn't involved. He wasn't an infectious disease specialist.
Nah, he was a C-suite guy.
Wow.
Into the opportunities about infectious diseases.
And actually there aren't that many, which is another dynamic we're going to be dealing with. All right, folks, we're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Alex Salmon on The Majority Report. Welcome back to The Majority Report. Joining us now is Alex Salmon. He's a staff writer for the American Prospect. His new piece, Barack Obama's Legacy is Narendra Modi, was just released in January. We're going to get to the piece in a minute. But Alex, Donald Trump was just in India. There have been a variety of very aggressive moves, some of which we've covered on the show, including the canceling of these Indian constitution and intensification of violence and occupation in Kashmir. citizenship bills, killing people in street protests, as well as actually more broad sort of culturally sanctioned acts of violence targeted at the Muslim community. Can you explain to us what's happening now in India from the Modi government towards India's Muslim population?
Absolutely. So there's been a kind of spasm of violence towards the Muslim population in India, which is a very significant minority there. It's, you know, hundreds of millions of Muslims live in India, and so you've kind of had this multi-pronged assault on the Muslim community that's accelerating in its intensity and severity lately. So you've had basically anti-Muslim pogroms kind of roaming the countryside. There have been, in the last couple of days, you know, dozens of Muslims have been killed by in riots, and then also kind of the acceleration of a handful of kind of bureaucratic and legislative attempts to do what I think the Economist called ethnic cleansing by bureaucracy. So they're, as you mentioned, the kind of citizenship bill that was being pursued by the Modi government to make it harder for Muslims to gain citizenship within India, and then also the occupation of Kashmir and the blockade up there. So it's kind of this kind of all-out assault on the Muslim community there, and it's something that's kind of been going on for months, but in the last couple of days we've seen really accelerate, and it's gotten quite acute.
What is the ideological origins of where this comes from? Explain the terms RSS and BJP to people and where Modi specifically fits into this.
Right. So Modi kind of got his start in the RSS, which is it's kind of a Hindu nationalist kind of paramilitary volunteer organization. And in the early 2000s, Modi kind of rose through the ranks as a propagandist for that group. So that's it's a group that kind of views it's a Hindu nationalist group at its core. So views kind of the Indian nationality as one that's bound up with Hinduism exclusively. And so that's kind of, I think that kind of gives you the ideological scaffolding to this whole thing. And from there, you know, Modi became kind of a rising star, and he got into the government formally, and he was the chief minister of Gujarat in the early 2000s, and kind of he rose as the face of this movement through the BJP, which is the political party that he represents and is now obviously the highest ranking member of. And as prime minister, you know, is leads the majority position that they hold.
And is BJP sort of subsumed by the RSS? Like, if the RSS is a broad kind of almost paramilitary or sort of broad NGO organization, has, publishing, community organizations, businesses, propaganda units, would it be fair to say that the BJP actually, as a political party, is almost an extension, not formally and legally, but that it isn't like the RSS is a cultural addendum that supports the BJP. It's more that the BJP is the electoral vehicle of the RSS.
I think that's fair to say. Yeah, it's a pretty broad, I mean, it's exactly as you described, right? It's a very broad kind of political alliance, but certainly the RSS is, given Modi's ties and given where the country's at currently, is very much in the driver's seat of this of the party as it's conceived. So yeah, it's certainly central to the operation as it currently exists.
One other piece of history that we should use to set this before we get specifically to the Obama administration relationship, and of course, we'll go to Trump, and it makes total sense why Trump and Modi and other, you know, anti-Muslim authoritarians would be friendly with each other. But Obama was quite friendly with Modi, even beyond basic geopolitics. But the other thing that we need to put in here is what happened when Modi was governor of Gujarat in 2002, or the chief minister of Gujarat in 2002. Can you explain that history again to everybody?
Absolutely. Yeah. So in 2002, there was an infamous incident. It became known as the Gujarat riots, and how it began was there was a train full of Hindu pilgrims, and it was on the way to some religious event in Gujarat, and a kind of it's still kind of contested what happened, but essentially a fight broke out on the train, and a number of those Hindu pilgrims were killed in this fight. And the backlash that kind of arose from that moment was intense and widespread. And what ended up happening was that it's estimated that, you know, 1,000 Muslims were killed basically in anti-Muslim riots across the state in the wake of this event on the train. And Modi, as essentially the governor of Gujarat at that time, basically the most generous thing to say about his contribution was that he stood idly by. Later investigations seem to indicate that he was basically encouraging of this anti-Muslim violence. And so the descriptions of what actually happened are so grisly, it's almost hard to imagine. Yeah. But you know, it was the violence was immense. It was brutal. It went on for quite a long time, and by the time you know, the death count occurred, and you know, it was upwards of 1,000 people, it was pretty clear that this was something that Modi at least tacitly encouraged as an event. So it was yeah, a shameful and violent moment, and something kind of set the tone here that I think is, you know, really important to remember as we see this violence kind of cropping back up.
So fast forward then to, and what year is Modi first elected Prime Minister of India? I believe is it 2014?
I think that's correct. Yeah.
So he's emerging, and there's several years where he is an international pariah. I believe he's not allowed to visit the United States. The national BJP, which is still part of the same, you know, extremist ideology, but he's actually for a little while, not, you know, maybe a bit sidelined in the party. And he's emerging, though. He's reassumed leadership of the party. He's leading in the polls in 2014. And President Obama has to deal with this, right? And I think we can go into the bigger questions of U.S. foreign policy and empire and things that we absolutely should. But that being said, to be put a really fine point on this, this isn't like Barack Obama saying, look, this guy is about to be in charge of the world's largest democracy. This is an incredibly strategically important country for us. It's a counterweight to, you know, China. There's a big business relationship. It's an emerging economy. There's a major Indian population in the United States. Obviously, I'm going to have to build some sort of relationship. He does a lot more than that. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think another kind of element that needs to be brought up here is that in Obama's second term, he had basically been, you know, thwarted on domestic policy at basically every level. So having lost the House and the Senate, was basically incapable of doing anything domestically. And the real power of the presidency at that point obviously resides in foreign policy. So Obama kind of turned to his foreign policy as a signature component of his second term. And one of these, you know, what I would argue is essentially a signature move within that kind of international statesmanship campaign that he was part of was the way that he dealt with Modi as Modi ascended through the ranks politically. And as you said, yeah, you know, Modi was on the international radar screen for a long time, and he was very much a pariah. But in 2014, he becomes prime minister, and rather than, you know, taking a really hard line with him or, you know, working to ensure that these extreme anti-Muslim views are going to at least be curtailed or sidelined, Obama reaches out to him and basically brings him into the fold as a personal guest at the White House. He brings him to the country multiple times for to preside over a session of Congress, and he goes himself to India on multiple occasions, all with the idea that that Modi is going to liberalize the economy and create more favorable business conditions for the American business class. And so he kind of gives Modi almost a blank check in just because Modi indicates that he's open to some market friendly reforms. And that kind of sets the tone here kind of going forward.
What is the role of a guy who some people might be familiar with, one of the most odious presences on Morning Joe, always freaking out about Bernie Sanders, or freaking out enough, Steve Rattner? Who's Steve Rattner? What's his kind of background and potential background? And what role did he play in the linkage between Modi and Obama?
Yeah, Ratner is an interesting character, and it's his kind of permanent role on morning news on MSNBC in these places is certainly a funny one. He was he's a Wall Street guy. He was a financier, and he got basically busted for running what was essentially a scam with the New York State Pension Fund towards the turn of the decade there, 2007, 2008. Obama appointed him to write the auto bailout, despite being essentially a white collar criminal. And then he kind of stayed within the Obama orbit. And when Obama was engaged in this kind of rehabilitation of Modi as a kind of rough around the edges true believer in markets that the Western world should get on board with, Ratner kind of did the cable television rounds and talked about how he had one point that India was actually not a site of injustice because it was had less wealth equality than the United States in 2014. So he kind of
wealth
kind of
inequality. Worked, you mean?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, okay, yeah. Wealth it. Inequality. Yeah. Yes, that's correct. And so he kind of he worked the various channels to soften the edges here and say, well, Modi, you might have concerns, but, India is not so bad. That there's less wealth inequality there than there is here. So how bad can it be? And so, he really helped part of the kind of wage this charm offensive in the mass media about Modi's reputation. And obviously is still kind of around doing similar work now for Michael Bloomberg as both his money manager and as a talking head that regularly disparages the wealth tax and other kind of progressive positions from people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, I was going to say the only time that he ever talked about closing the inequality gap as a good thing was when he was defending to Narendra Modi, as far as I can tell.
Right.
So now, in the last several years, I guess I hesitate to do this, but I mean, the history is really clear and really established. Everybody knows who Modi is. People know what that ideology is. I could, and also even just a whole other terrain of really valid critiques, which is in fact all of these market reforms, which, we always know what that means. It's anti-labor, anti-poor, and it benefits local rich people and the U.S. investor class. We know all of this. I mean, certainly anybody listening to or watching this knows the, correct and familiar critique of Washington-led neoliberalization. I could see people who want to defend Obama in this sort of jumping up and down and saying, hey, he needed to have a relationship with Modi because of the strategic importance. And, didn't things get really bad in India after Obama was out of office? Didn't Modi make some noises when he first got into power of, not being somebody who would stand to the sidelines or probably even encourage and maybe even participate in the mass murder of Muslims? And by the way, also some Christians as well, that he was, that he was kind of, sure, obviously a man of the right, but not this kind of brutal authoritarian ethnic cleanser we're seeing form now. Is that, is that in any way? I mean, obviously, I don't think so. Obama hasn't got an endless amount of Twitter followers. He could at least put one tweet out and say, hey, Narendra, that's not good. but that being said, I mean, is there a big qualitative difference in the behavior between Obama and Trump? And is that in any way exculpatory?
Well, I think that you're right to kind of set up those caveats that, of course, as the leading politician of the world's largest democracy, Obama can say, I'm not going to engage with this person at all under any circumstances and pretend he didn't exist. He had to engage with him. That's certainly true. But I do think that if you look at the track record of who he elevated, especially in places in the world where we're seeing democracy falter now, and even compared to George W. Bush. So I'd say that, when Modi was ascending in 2005, he tried to get a visa to come to the United States and kind of, you know, workshop his image and get himself out there as an international figure. And the Bush administration decided that his track record was too odious and that they couldn't issue him a visa because of his record on religious violence because of those riots was so unequivocal that they refused to do it. And this is the Bush administration,
right?
You know, and this is not a group of you know, administrators that thought that, you know, violence against Muslims was such a horrible, unthinkable
the leading cause of violence against Muslims. The Abu Ghraib guys said you went too far. I think probably because there were Christians killed there too. I think, let's be real. But that being said, you know, yes, they said no to Modi.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think this, you know, that's a pretty powerful comparison. And I think that too, if you look at you know, who else Obama elevated or cozied up to during that period. You had Erdogan in Turkey, who initially the Obama administration was quite enthusiastic about. They were close. They initially said that they considered Mubarak to be an ally in Egypt, and then they said that Mohamed Morsi in Egypt was someone that they kind of saw eye to eye with. So, you know, and now, you know, look at Egypt, look at Turkey, look at these democracies and where they are currently. You know, they're teetering on the edge. And so I think that, you know, yes, you have to be realistic about the fact that as president of the United States, you have to forge alliances with people that maybe you don't like and you can't pretend they're not there. But I do think that the Obama administration did a lot of work to elevate leaders that we knew their track records, we knew what they were interested in, and they've kind of taken that endorsement and kind of run these major democracies into the ground. And obviously, Trump has no real problem with that, but he's certainly not going to be a bulwark against it as we kind of get into this advanced stage of decline for, you know, India, Turkey, Egypt, and elsewhere.
Well, what do you make then in the last couple of minutes of that broader charge there, that broader critique that, roughly, you know, simply speaking, in the United States and in across the sort of democratic world, the argument between the center right basically is, you know, this is an aberration and we just need to go back to the politics of the 1990s and, you know, actually have fairly similar policies. Maybe we do need to, you know, because again, don't forget that the very repressive and nasty policies towards immigrants and refugees were accelerated in the 90s in the United States and in Europe. But, you know, yes, we shouldn't have these really particularly loud people like an Erdogan or a Modi or a Bolsonaro or a Trump. And then folks, you know, as exemplified by Sanders, but others on the left who say, well, look here, like taking even just the Obama administration specifically, and I'm, you know, I'm speaking for myself here, not certainly folks in a campaign or anything, but the policy sets that deindustrialized parts of the country, the utter rot of the political system. You know, as Bill Fletcher Jr. says, you know, right-wing populism is the herpes of capitalism. And then even more specifically, at the time that Obama's cozying with Modi, the DOJ is backing a right-wing, political task force in Brazil to destroy Lula and the Workers' Party because quite obviously it seems that, you know, because for all of their willingness to work with the United States, the Workers' Party is not willing to privatize and make allowable certain kind of key strategic assets to U.S. investors. That, I mean, the overlap there is obvious. So at what point do we say, like, not only do we need to kind of reach for much deeper reforms to deal with this authoritarian pull, but that actually the neoliberal leadership, for lack of a better term, was the sort of key conduit force for the Modis and the Bolsonaros and the Trumps of the world?
Oh yeah, I think that's absolutely. I mean, I think that's absolutely correct, and I think that's something that we've seen, over decades, is that that in fact the kind of liberal democracy playing nice with the neoliberal economic reforms, those two things don't necessarily go together very well. And in fact, they oftentimes are at odds. And even in places where you have very limited, democratic governance, it still ends up being sacrificed on the altar of business reforms. And it seems, yeah, absolutely, you know, we can trace this out in a number of places, but the pull of the business class, the pull of the investor class, is going to supersede these democratic ambitions or the liberal democracy is going to fall short of basically the demands of the business class, and we've seen that over and over again, and so that certainly has set the tone, and in a lot of ways I think was probably inevitable. I mean, the supremacy of that investor class, of that with that kind of wave of privatization and stuff, it just doesn't work with the democratic system, and we've seen that again and again, and this is now just the byproduct. And I think that it's certainly not an aesthetic problem that the leadership is ornery and unpleasant. It's a much bigger structural one, and I think that's kind of what. Yeah, I think as you wisely point out, that Sanders and other people primarily Sanders, and he was in fact the only one who was willing to condemn the violence in India.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I just want to say specifically. I mean, it's not obviously. Look, I support Sanders. That's obvious. But specifically, if we're talking about foreign policy, I happen to think on domestic policy, it's completely he's in a league of his own on domestic policy. I think without question. But I get that people want to debate that. Setting that aside. Nobody with any kind of straight face could debate this on foreign policy. He's the only one. And in fact, there was a tweet yesterday from a BJP leader in India responding to Sanders condemning human rights abuses, saying, "We're going to need to respond," essentially threatening to interfere in this election, along, by the way, of course, with Israel, because, Sanders called Netanyahu a reactionary racist, which is, again, it's obvious to anybody who knows anything. As well as calling for Lula to be free. So that isn't just like making a case for Sanders. I just think if we're going to talk about these things with any kind of seriousness, we need to be really real about what it actually means to take a step in the right direction of actually addressing these things. Because kind of broad, hey, you should be nice to each other statements are not going to do anything when, in India, they, again, as you said, I mean, the Economist sees... They are assembling an ethnic cleansing state while allowing people to literally lynch people in the country. I mean, this is happening right now.
Right, absolutely. Right. I mean, it's just that the economic conditions, right, the economic policies that are sought by these people are consistent. They're the ones that neoliberal consensus has advocated for. And, it's something that if the pharmaceutical industry can erode the generic, generic drug market in India, which is a big part of India as the foremost producer of generic drugs, well, they don't really have a huge issue with ethnic violence or ethnic cleansing by bureaucracy or however else you do it. If they can if they can add to the portfolio, that has been fine. And that's been fine the world over, and that's been fine for many decades. And it absolutely comes down to the kind of way we think about the global economy. And in a lot of ways, this is the business class getting what they've sought for years, and it's not at odds with their goals. And so, yeah, I think you're right to analyze it in those terms, because this foreign policy stuff is very much about the priorities of the economy, and it's about labor, and it's about a number of other things. So that's around the money.
I'll trade you an Islamic detention center for a AIDS drug out of the generics. How about that?
Yeah, it's
let's write an op-ed about yoga together. It'll be great. By the way, that's not a joke. They did that. I think it was in the Washington Post, right?
Oh, is that so?
Modi first visited the United States, him and Obama wrote it wasn't about yoga, but it was what they started with, ever since Swami Vivekananda came to the World Conference on Religions, we've had a special relationship. Oprah, stress relief. Anyways, all right, no more generic drugs. And in exchange, you can reverse the Mughal Empire or whatever. Cool. It's a really, really important piece in obviously a place in the world where a lot of horrifying things are happening right now. Alex, with the support of the U.S. corporate class, Alexander Salmon, the piece is Barack Obama's Legacy is Narendra Modi. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks a lot. Take care. All right, folks, read that piece in the American Prospect that'll be linked. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Subscribe to the AM Quickie on iTunes. Immediately go become a patron, patreon.com/TMBS. This weekend, in a illicit history and primer of the history of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, what exactly is the Taliban today, the state of play in Syria, CIA, Gulf, Russia, where we are, and more with Derek Davidson. Don't miss our latest show with Benjamin Dixon and Richard Wolff. Next week, I'll be in L.A. with Nomiki Kantz. Grab your tickets. That's going to be an amazing thing. We're going to stream that on the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. Go over there and subscribe. And I believe we're going to be doing our main Michael Brooks Show next Saturday. Get your tickets. April 3rd at the North Door in Austin, Texas. Anna Kasparian, Abby Martin. We are now well over a half sold out, so I would get them quickly. Patrons of the Michael Brooks Show just got an email announcing our live show in Boston in June. I would go to that link so you can get your Patreon discount to that live show this Sunday. Check out on my Twitter page, Twitter wall, or Daniel Denver's. Brianna, Daniel Denver, and I are going to be doing a podcast Sunday morning in Boston and then going and canvassing for Bernie Sanders. Patreon.com/TMBS. Matt.
My podcast, Literary Hangover. Check it out. Most recent episode on Bacon's Rebellion, which is something people should know about. So check it out.
Great. Check out the Nomiki Show and the Antifada. We'll see you in the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.